You're listening to the Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hey there, welcome to the Dr. Nina Show. I'm Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin. I'm a psychoanalyst specializing in food, weight, and body image issues. And I'm here to help you lose weight without dieting and also talk about all kinds of subjects pertaining to mind and body health. So today I have a really special guest that I am going to introduce in just a little bit. We're going to talk about body image, sexuality, and shame. And we're going to talk with Lauren Brim, who I'm going to introduce in a moment. But first, I want to share an email I just got today from a listener. And she writes, as a child, I experienced several years of sexual abuse and then rape at 19. Most of my life, I've carried extra weight up to 150 pounds at times. I've always been told that I had a beautiful face if only I'd lose a little weight. In my early 30s, I became thin and got so much attention from men, it scared the heck out of me. And for 2 years or so, I walked around feeling so disconnected from my body and ungrounded. I remember being perplexed, trying on my pre-150-pound weight loss jeans and saying to myself, oh my God, I'm not safe anymore. Fast forward a decade or so, and I'm 150-plus pounds heavier. I hate my body, and yet I dream daily of being thin. I'm scared to death to be beautiful again, and know I have stronger boundaries so I could tell guys to take a hike when they flirted with me. But how do I lose the deep-seated fear, belief, and shame that I won't be safe if I'm thin and that it's okay to be healthy? This is such a well-said and heart-wrenching, poignant email from Robin in Canada. And I just wanted to introduce the subject today by talking about her email, and then my guest is and I are going to talk about what she said. So my guest, Lauren Brim, is a former Radio City Rockette turned doula turned sexual wellness expert and female empowerment coach. She's also the author of two books, The New Rules of Sex and The New American Family, and she's finishing a PhD in human sexuality. Just a little bit more about Lauren. She was started practicing mind-body medicine in 2004 after it helped her heal from a fractured spine while dancing, and she's worked in the healing arts for over a decade. She began to specialize in women's sexual health after training to be a midwife and realized that no one in healthcare was talking with women about their sexuality. And she has written a really remarkable book, The New Rules of Sex, which, as we were talking before the show, I told her it was sort of part treatise, a very well-researched, very, very specific and detailed account of sexuality through the ages in the Bible, why we think the way we think, all the way to modern times, as well as her own autobiographical experience. So I'm really excited to be talking with her today. Welcome, Lauren, to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So when you hear Robin's email,
yeah,
what are your first thoughts about that?
Just that it represents what so many people feel, that to be sexual is unsafe, that sexuality is unsafe, that men or women being attracted to her is unsafe, and that this shame is bigger than her. This is a societal issue, and we need to slowly overcome this and heal this by having conversations that normalize sexuality, by talking about desire, making it okay, making it safe for women to be sexual. So that's what stands out to me.
Yeah, and I also think I would add to that, Robin, if you're listening, and anyone else who can relate to what Robin said, this idea that if you're an object of attraction, you're going to be an object of abuse or rape, or that someone is going to be able to take control of your body or do something to you. And so often women who have been in this situation or not, lots of people are very frightened about sex and they keep their bodies in a way that they think no one would be interested in as a way to avoid being overpowered.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that also speaks to our own fears of our, as women, our desire. Because often our desires are sort of displaced onto food. Like, no, no, good girls, nice girls don't want to have sex. Men want to have sex. Girls don't want to have sex. Everything you want, don't want that. But, you know, want the Oreos.
Right. And I like what you said about the displacement with food, because I think we also displace that. We can displace that on other people. Oh, look how big their sexual desire is. I'm afraid of them. But she might be afraid of her own sexual desire and how large that is. And, you know, my question as a sex coach and counselor would be, okay, what's going on with your own self-pleasuring practice? And, you know, how comfortable are you with pleasure and sexuality? Because as you start to uncover what your desire is, other people having desire isn't going to be so scary, because you've gone there, you've looked at it, you've had pleasure, you know, with that, and it'll help to change how she relates to other people.
Yeah, and you bring up a good point about pleasure, because when people do not get enough pleasure in their lives, they are often vulnerable to using, in the case of, you know, people listening to this show, many of them vulnerable to using food, to eating for their primary source of pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you get more fun in your life in other areas, the food becomes less the only thing that you're looking for to sex, to pleasure. That was a Freudian slip. What did I mean? I have no idea what I mean.
Sex, pleasure, food. Yeah,
sex,
well, I mean,
it's
one of the things we talk about in sociology, and is how interesting is it that with the people that are potential sexual partners, what do? You go out and you eat food with them, and you share food, and it's very sensual and very erotic to eat. And, you know, as we talked about briefly in Chinese medicine, the mouth and the genitals have this connection. So as we're filling our mouths, it's a way of, it's no different than being filled up with sexual pleasure. You know, when we're aroused, our genitals are engorged. We are literally filled up with blood, both men with their penile erection and women. You know, we have the exact same tissue inside of us that engorges with blood and wants to be penetrated and wants to be filled up. So I think it's very interesting wanting to be filled up with food and that satiation versus filled up and engorged with blood and connected to another human being, you know, penetrated by them emotionally, sexually, spiritually, on all those levels.
Yeah, you said that as a midwife, you learned, it was very interesting about that connection. I was taught early in, you know, when I was in my doctoral training, that Freud was the one who came up with this idea that there was a connection between mouth and vagina, and this was supposedly brand new in the early 1900s. No one was talking about it. You corrected me.
Mm.
It's actually ancient Chinese.
Yes.
But
yes, for thousands of years, the Chinese have known that there is a connection between the mouth and the genitals in both men and women, and it's connected via the conception vessel, which is one of the deeper meridians, so it's called an ancestral meridian. So this means that it is connected to our DNA, to our ancestors, to now what we have a term for, which are epigenetics, which means that it literally, the experiences of your ancestors get carried down through your DNA, through these methyl markers on the genes, and your grandmother's sexual trauma could show up as sexual trauma for you through this ancestral meridian. So yes, there is it's a deep connection. It's connected to food and family and sex and body image and metabolism, and the Chinese have known about it all along. We're just catching up.
Those Chinese are so ahead of us in so many ways. You know, I really liked one of the things that you said in the book, which is sex. You said sex is simply being close with another human with whom you have a great attraction and sometimes love.
Mm.
But that's not the way that we often experience it. It becomes dangerous. It becomes threatening. It becomes something that we want to avoid. If we feel sexual, we feel like sluts if we're women, or we dodge it. One of my patients just last week said to me, she sort of put her hands over her body, and she said, "I can't even stand the look of this," you know, with disgust. Her voice dripped with disgust. She's like, "So how can a guy ever want to be with me?" And so this shame about our bodies, shame about our needs, is really pervasive.
Yeah, in men and women. I mean, we sometimes think this is a female issue, but men experience it as well. this deep shame that that affects everything. You know, it affects sexuality, but it affects how we, I believe, every aspect of our life, career, how we negotiate, you know, with our finances, and it affects so many things, because at the deepest part, the essence of it is our sense, you know, sexuality is so close to the essence of who we are. And if we accept our bodies and our sexuality, we're saying, I'm lovable, I'm okay, I have a place in this world, my desire has a place in this world, my reproductive capacities do. I mean, to have sex and make a baby is to literally duplicate yourself on the planet. And yeah, it's deeply connected with that self-relationship, self-love.
And so many people are at war with their bodies, right? They don't say, oh, my body is me. You know, it becomes something to battle. Like, I'm not going to let myself eat, blah, blah, blah. I'm not going to let myself go out with that person. I'm not, and well, who's the I and who's the self? Right? You know, like, you're one person. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of being one, it sounds so simple, but we're sort of taught to be at war with our needs, our urges, our wishes, our desires.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think that we are brought up to view the body as bad, sexuality as sinful, desire as, you know, if you follow your desires, it'll take you right down the alley into drugs and teenage pregnancy. And like, we just have this cultural narrative that, as opposed to being taught, well, what is your body saying? We think if you say, what does your body want to eat? You're just going to want cookies all the time. No, you're going to want like a nice, warm, home-cooked meal, because, you know, your body's going to crave something good. And, you know, I desire sex right now. Like, let's go towards that. Or I desire a hug. Let's go towards that. But we're raised to not do that. You know, the sins of the body sort of thing. So absolutely, we need to get back in our bodies to start to validate pleasure. And that's why I think in the New Rules of Sex, I spent a lot of time talking about the studies that have shown the health benefits. Because, you know, if I'm just sitting here going, sex is great, you're going to go, yeah, right, Lauren. But if I say, no, it lowers your risk of heart disease, breast cancer, prostate cancer, improves your sleep, helps with weight loss, improves immunity immediately. If I ever feel like I'm getting sick, the first thing I want is an orgasm, you know, and some sleep and some vitamin C. I'm like, there's science here. And I feel like that can help some of that powerful story we all have from religion and culture that it's bad.
Yeah, and you really go beautifully in depth to the underlying reasons why we fear sex and why it's so good for us that we don't even think about, like you said, that it helps depression, it helps all of those things you mentioned and more. So this mind-body connection, you know, when I was thinking, have you ever heard of GLEV paralysis?
No.
GLEV paralysis is something that is, people are always saying, what is this mind-body connection?
Okay.
Like, come on, Dr. Nina, what are you talking about? It's not in my head, this is real, or whatever.
Yeah.
So I tell them about the GLEV paralysis. So in the era of Freud,
okay,
this was very common. And what would happen was women would lose all feeling in their one of their arms, the mm-hmm. arm that, you know, whatever, if they were right-handed, it would be their right hand. If they were left-handed, it would be their left hand. And they would lose all sensation from their elbows to their fingertips. They could not move their fingers. And it was very prevalent in this sort of post-Victorian repressed society.
Mm.
And Freud came to realize that actually it was the mind was so afraid of masturbation
mm-hmm.
that women would start to develop it around the time that they would discover masturbation, and it was so prohibited that they would literally lose all sensation in their hands, so they couldn't do it. And that was such a strong example of how powerful our minds are mm-hmm. over our bodies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that numbness that those women experienced in their hands because of how prohibited masturbation was. I mean, they said at the time it led to insanity, death, you know, problems with your children. I mean, that masturbation was just considered the root of all evil. We see that currently in the numbness in genitals and, you know, women who say, I just don't feel anything. And it's mm-hmm. like, you can. And the nerves are there. You just have to move past that, you know, like these women, the fear and the shame.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so powerful. Why do you think that now people are being more open to having a different experience. Why are people coming to you? What do you see most often in your clients?
Well, it's kind of two questions in one, but some are saying that we're experiencing another sexual revolution. We're talking about sex in the media. We still have a long way to go for sex education in schools. But there have been a lot of the taboos lifted as far as parents now telling kids that, you know, masturbation is a healthy practice. We've taken homosexuality out of, you know, it's no longer a mental illness. I mean, we are making steps towards talking about sexuality, making it sane and safe. So I think that is a big part of it. I'm sure social media and the internet are helping, radio shows like this. What do I see in my clients? I work primarily with women, and I see that a lot of them just don't enjoy sex that much, don't have a libido that they feel they should. Mm-hmm. And so a big part of that work is helping to uncover the stories within them, going back to childhood where they've been shamed, or, you know, what information they've picked up, and then helping to give them a new story of sexuality, start to open up some possibilities, which is what I tried to do with the new rules of sex and what I do with my individual clients.
Well, let's also open up the phone lines. Ooh. If you would like to talk with Lauren, and now is your chance, 818-602-4929. That's 818-602-4929. You know, the thing that I see most with my patients and my clients is, again, very similar to what Robin, who wrote in, says, this fear. So what are things that people can do? What steps can people do to quiet their minds of the fear of sexuality?
Well, we need to create safety and safe experiences. So the incredible thing about the human body and brain is this neuroplasticity that we have. We can rewire. So if you can create a really safe environment for yourself at home to begin self-pleasuring and start to explore your genitals, you know, penetration not required, you know, just start to explore your body, your breasts, your skin, wherever you want to touch in a safe way, that starts to connect your brain to this idea of sexuality is safe, and your cortisol is going to go down, the good hormones are going to start to get produced. But I think also, because we're such social creatures, we need to surround ourselves with positive ways of looking at sexuality. You need to read books like The New Rules of Sex. You need to listen to, you know, shows and hang out with people who are sex positive. There's even an organization called Sex Positive World, and you can connect with people that go, hey, sexuality is a beautiful, awesome thing. And when we hang out with people that think that way, we start to think that way. So I think those are two things people can do.
You know, when I was a kid, I lived in London for a year, from like 10 to 12. And I remember that here I was in England, and there would be all these commercials with, like, women with, you know, bare breasts and super sexy. And, of course, not the guys. It's always the women, right? And I was like, how is that? Like, this is supposed to be such a repressed, you know, British upper lip, stiff upper lip society. And their position was, wait, you people show violence all the time. You have no problem with violence and having, you know, people's heads exploding off their bodies. But, oh, my God, God forbid they should see a breast. Mm-hmm. And so there's something backwards in our culture where we're not afraid of violence, but the human body is something that is mortifying as a culture.
Every culture has this. You know, some societies we look at, we say, oh, I don't like what they're doing to women, or they're so suppressed in this way or that way, and then you talk to them and find out they're really free in other ways. And sometimes that's with sexuality. And I was in Malaysia earlier this year talking to a local woman there, and I said, oh, the women must, you know, are they very suppressed sexually? Because I'd heard there was all this female genital mutilation there, and the women are all covered. And she goes, are you kidding? No, the female genital mutilation they do here is symbolic. It's like a little prick of blood. And if they prick and blood isn't released, they actually get animal blood. And I was like, oh, that's kind of reminds me of some other things I'd heard from other cultures. And she said, no, they're screwing all the time, she told me. Like, and women are enjoying sex. And I just thought, wow, I never would have guessed that. And then here in Los Angeles, people always talk about how sexual everyone looks and appears in the movies, and yet I've had people say that, you know, these there's less sex happening in Los Angeles than in many other places in the country. So isn't it interesting that sometimes things aren't always what they appear?
Absolutely. I remember some years ago I was at this Cajun club, and if it's your birthday, you could go up and dance, right? And so there was like this woman who looked like she was just surgically altered in every way, mm-hmm. like fake lips, fake boobs, like super super skin, like she just looked like Barbie. I mean, she looked like Barbie, like everything about her was fake, but perfect. Mm. And she got up there, and there were these other women, and they were, let's just say, women of size. And they were just so damn sexy. They were so comfortable in their bodies, and they were dancing. And mm-hmm. and this woman who was perfect was like, she was so stiff and uncomfortable in her body. And it was so mm-hmm. clear that there was a disconnect between the way she looked, and clearly inside she was just so uptight. Mm-hmm. You know, she could not dance. And if you can't dance, you know, mm-hmm. probably not going to be able to have sex.
That is a very true statement. Yeah, how someone dances is how they are in bed. I was even thinking as I pulled up to the radio station today, you know, you could say like how you eat is how you live, how you have sex is how you live. I mean, these are like deep reflections. They kind of reflect across the board who we are. And I think that's, you know, interesting. We bring up weight gain as a way of sort of keeping people away, shielding ourselves, protecting ourselves. But we also, you know, have decided somehow as a culture that being super thin is the only sexually attractive thing. Whereas, I mean, if there's anything the Kardashians have taught us, is that we love curvy, beautiful women, that weight is not an indicator. I see that with clients too. They say, oh, no one's going to want to be with me because I'm, you know, this many pounds overweight. I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, do you realize like how delicious it is to connect with another human being and just kiss and hug and touch? And like, it doesn't matter.
Well, I think women think that men think that way. Mm-hmm. And yes, there are men who think that way. They've been indoctrinated by the culture and they say, well, totally. This is what I have to be with. But most men, as one guy put it, he's like, I'm just happy to be there. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not wondering if you're, you know, if you have an ounce of or 10 pounds or 20 pounds, of heaviness around your thighs. He's just happy to be around thighs.
Yeah. And so, if you own those thighs, you're going to find people that are attracted to those specific things. Like, we're so aware of the mainstream, you know, desire and attraction. And it's taboo to even say I'm attracted to women with, you know, larger butts, or I'm attracted to this or that. I've had partners that have all different types of body types, and I find them all attractive. So I think as we start to even have those alternate sexual experiences, we go, I say it's just like with food. You know, when I first moved to France, I was like, oh no, I don't eat escargot. And then I was at someone's house eating this incredible escargot paired with wine in this amazing setting. And I went, apparently I do like snails. You know, it's just like, and it's the same with sex. We have to explore and like expand our sexual palate is what I say with clients.
Yeah. And you're talking on some level about trust, self-trust. Mm. That we don't trust ourselves. In fact, we're taught not to trust ourselves. That's what, especially with food. I mean, yesterday was Halloween, and last Halloween, I've told the story a lot. Last Halloween, my daughter and we were trick-or-treating, and my daughter said, I'm hungry. And my husband said, well, have some candy. You've got like a pillowcase full of candy. Have some candy. And she goes, no, I don't want candy. I want real food. Mm-hmm. And that's because I was so proud of her in that moment. It's like, yes! because I've taught her to listen to her body, mm-hmm. and not taught her that these foods are bad and these foods are good, and that you're good if you have these foods and bad if you don't, or that you're supposed to eat this particular thing at this particular time. Mm-hmm. All that does, also known as dieting, mm-hmm. all that does is disconnect us from our true needs and wants. And mm-hmm. I would imagine it's the same with sex. We kind of mm. are told how we're supposed to be, how we're supposed to feel, and then we try to live up to that mm-hmm. rather than trust and discover who we are.
Yeah, and that discovery, it you know, you should have it as a child and moving into adulthood. And if you've missed that and you're an adult listening to this, you can give that to yourself now, you know, but you have to make time to explore sexuality, pleasure, self-pleasuring, and start to really lay the foundation for yourself of, you know, what am I attracted to? And noticing things in the media and in books, and start to discover who are you as a sexual being.
Someone else had written me today, I'm not going to try to find the email, but she said she had basically lost 80 pounds, and she was in this relationship with someone, and it was sexless.
Hmm.
And she had lost 80 pounds, and now he's more interested in being with her. And she is terrified.
Hmm.
You know? And I think when you feel as if someone is doing something to you, mm-hmm. rather than with you, you're a participant, that is terrifying. You become like a little girl that someone's doing, you know, you're being overtaken instead of being there with someone and actually having it be a mutual, enjoyable experience.
Mm-hmm.
What would you add to this person who, her name is Debbie, who feels so frightened of anything sexual? She also has a history of terrible abuse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, again, once she discovers her sexual desire, she needs to start communicating when she wants to have sex, initiating things like just kissing and hugs, or starting to talk about what she's feeling or fantasizing about or wanting. You know, these are all important first steps, setting boundaries within that. No, I don't like that, but how about we try this? And it, you know, it just makes me think too again about the societal and the lineage experience that we've had as women, which is it was at one point illegal to have sex in any position but missionary. I mean, if a woman was to not be on her back having sex, this was considered a sin. And some of the positions that are the most enjoyable for women, that women are most likely to have a clitoral orgasm, being on top, the superior position, vaginal orgasms on hands and knees. I mean, even giving birth is easier in that position, and yet women were put on their back. So we've been dominated for thousands of years. And you know, back in the Middle Ages, when like religion, Christianity was at its height, you were told when there were so many days you couldn't have sex when you were menstruating, couldn't have sex on the holidays, couldn't have sex when you were pregnant, couldn't have sex after you had the baby. So when you finally had sex, you were so riddled with desire, you'd probably be ovulating, immediately get pregnant, and then go back into a sexless period. And the only position you could have was on your back. I mean, we need to reclaim our sexuality in this space, in this country, in our relationships. I talk to women who are super educated and beautiful and seemingly empowered, and they say, I'm too shy to tell my husband I want sex. So I just sort of walk around like half naked and hope he'll initiate. And I go, what are you doing? You mm-hmm. have desire. You need to voice it. Like, that is your power. So I think, it's not going to happen overnight. It's going to be lots of little steps, but realizing she's not alone, and that it's something that's doable, and that a lot of pleasure and a better sex life is going to come from it is important to understand.
Yeah, that's great advice. I'm also thinking as you're talking about the hashtag MeToo, which is sort of the reverse of that, that we are starting to claim our power and say no. If we claim our power and we say no, you cannot do that to me. I will not do that with you or to you. You know, it feels more empowering. So, however, when you say no, it also helps you say yes.
Mm-hmm.
To no to what you don't want, getting in touch with the ability that you have to be able to set those boundaries, and it helps you practice saying yes to yourself when mm-hmm. you say no to people.
Yeah, and I'd also like to add, there's also that beautiful in-between space, which is not right now, but if you went and did the dishes and maybe folded some laundry, I bet I'd want to have sex with you later. Or, you know, if you, you know, there's maybe the, I don't feel like having sex, but how about cuddling for 10 minutes? Or, you know, starting to, it doesn't always have to be a hard yes and a hard no. It can be, what do I really want? You know, maybe this.
That is great advice for when you're with someone you may want to be with. I guess true. I was speaking to the Harvey Weinsteins, yes, and the, you know, all, yes, of these.
But people. Even with that, I actually made a YouTube video about that this week, about the Me Too. And I said, you know, when we are regularly voicing our desire and our yes and our no and really getting in touch with that inner trust that you talked about, if someone comes up and propositions something or tries to push something, we're so used to having that conversation. We go, what do you think you're saying? No, you know, put your pants back on. Like, that's not what's happening right now. Mm-hmm. Because we're so used to having a conversation and navigating those boundaries. Whereas if we haven't, then we go into shock and then don't know how to handle it and lose our voice. And it's more traumatic. So I think the more we have conversations in general, it helps us even in those because they're unavoidable. I mean, people are going to, I mean, I lived in New York City for 5 years and people are drunk and they wander in and start masturbating in front of you. And you can go, oh my God, I'm such a victim. Or you can go like, no, and call the police and walk to the next subway car, you know? And it's like, that's right. The difference between, and the just like, oh, I'm going to handle this.
Yeah, the more practice that you get at anything, the easier it is. I take Krav Maga, and when I was first starting, you know, as women, we're not used to, like, hitting each other or wrestling around or any of those things. Like, guys grow up punching each other and wrestling, and they're very used to physical contact. And so when I first started and I had to get used to that idea of being pushed and shoved and then you freeze because you're not used to it.
Interesting.
And then in time, of course, then you learn to react. I mean, their whole thing is they teach you how to react really fast. So it's the same thing with anything. If you're not used to doing something, you will freeze. But if you are practiced, it's very easy to say,
Which is why we need the comprehensive sex education programs in schools that we're seeing now in California, that we're seeing in parts of Canada. They start when kids are 5-6 years old talking about sexuality, which everyone freaks out. But what they start talking about are boundaries, you know, like how to say no, how to say yes, what, you know, these parts of your body belong to you. And, you know, start to, because so much of sexuality is negotiating and navigating those boundaries and having the practice to respond in the moment and not freeze. So I think that's very cool. I think we should have kids doing martial arts, dance, all these things so that they learn how, you know, they learn about their bodies and can really embody their bodies as opposed to what you talked about warring against them or, you know, not feeling them. And I think that's one of the gifts for me of being a dancer, you know, and luckily too, I had a mother who I remember one day saying, you know, it's perfectly good to masturbate. You know that, right? And she didn't have any other conversations with me about sexuality or menstruation or anything like that. But I say that was a gift that she gave me. And if we can just give each other a little bit more permission to be sexual, and you know, we do that as adults too. It's a really great thing.
Right. It's so hidden. It's like this dirty little secret. And it's so, for so many people, it gets associated with shame. And, of course, the difference between guilt and shame, guilt is, oh, I feel so bad about what I did or what I didn't do. Like, I feel bad about the behavior. Whereas shame is, oh, I feel bad about myself. There's something wrong with me. And I think it's so important that we de-shame sexuality.
Yeah, when you say that, it makes me think about the eating that I see some of my clients do too, and it's very like hidden away and secret, and in the same way that sexuality is very hidden and secret, and yeah, there's clearly some similarities there.
Yeah, desire is frowned on. Right? Desire is something that is like almost like a sin or some, you know, it's just looked on askance as opposed to a natural, healthy part of us, whether we're desiring food, sex, connection, love, anything. It's healthy. It's natural. We so much have learned to turn against what's healthy and natural, and as a result, we're avoiding what we feel by bad things like turning to food, turning to working too much, gambling, sex addiction, all kinds of different things to avoid ourselves.
Yeah.
So if you would like to talk with me and Lauren today, the number is 818-602-4929. I think that you talk about in the book, let me see, you talked about in the book some very personal things that you learn yourself about this, getting back to the mind-body connection.
Mm. I love the mind-body connection.
Love the
Let's
mind-body connection.
Yeah.
Yeah. What, can you share, there's so many examples, but can you share your thoughts on the mind-body connection from your perspective?
In relationship to sexuality or anything?
Anything. Yeah.
Well, you know, the way I got into this work was, as you said, I was dancing with the Radio City Rockettes, and I fractured my L5 vertebrae and was immediately taken out of the show. And then I just, my body didn't heal. It wasn't healing, and I was doing all these sort of alternative therapies in New York, as well as the regular Western stuff. And I finally had a what's called a body talk session from my friend's mom, and my back spasms immediately cleared up. And all she did was basically go through my history and found some memories that were unresolved, what we call active memories, where I had some trauma that had been triggered or stimulated by my current life situation. And for me, it was a story about being all alone in the world. And so when I was doing the show, I'd just gone through a breakup, I felt all alone in the world, and I had some earlier memories of that. And so that just immediate cessation of my back spasms and back pain just completely changed my life. You know, here I was as an athlete taught to, oh, if you have an injury, if something's not right, you strengthen it. If you have pain, you take an ibuprofen. I mean, that was where I was operating from. And I did go on to learn a lot about diet and other things, but that was such a real experience for me. And I think I've just always been someone that wants to explore kind of what's behind the next corner. And so that naturally came to me with sexuality, that I was always curious. And I think anything you bring curiosity to is really, it's really powerful. And so with sexuality, I was just always exploring. You know, I was orgasmic. I did enjoy sex. I'd have moments where I'd get traumatized and, you know, my boyfriends would go like, what's going on? You froze, you look freaked out. I'm like, I don't know. You know, I'd have to work through stuff. I discovered new types of orgasm, new levels of letting go. You know, the mysterious female ejaculation, you know, all
the carrot.
Yeah, it's like,
you guys are going to have to read the book to learn about the carrot.
That story. I know. I was just on a mission. I had this friend who was like, yeah, I ejaculate. And I'm like, what is she talking about? And even now doing my PhD in human sexuality, you still listen to lectures by people going, the G-spot absolutely does not exist. And women don't. And then, you know, go read Women's Anatomy of Arousal. She'll show you exactly what those periurethral glands look like, and they release ejaculate from your urethra in the same way that we create breast milk and release it with our letdown when we nurse our babies. And anyway, it doesn't have to be a goal with sexuality. And you know, the idea with sex is to just be present with whatever experience you have and to really be in your body. But yeah, I was curious. I wanted to explore it all, so I share a lot of those stories, and the good, the bad, and the ugly. You know, I didn't want to just put myself up and say, let me tell you all my best stories and all my best orgasms and my best relationships. I also share the really messy ones and the relationship to like depression and fear and you know, what I considered failure at the time and all of that.
Yeah, we can't just show our best because that's not real.
That's social media.
Yes, I know. Like, take 100 pictures and choose one and act like it just happened.
Yeah.
But it's not real. It's not human. You know, we're messy.
We are very messy.
And how can anyone really relate to us if we are too picture perfect?
Mm.
It's why I'm actually changing all my photos on my website, because my husband told me, he's like, Nina, I have to tell you, you have veered into Dallas real estate agent territory. No offense to Dallas real estate agents. If you're listening, I'm so sorry. But there's a certain look that does not say, I am a warm, accessible human psychoanalyst who can help you. It sort of says, I read the news and sell houses. That's what it looks like. And I was like, you're right. You're right. I don't even look like me. I don't want to look like some super, you know, teased out hair, over made up version of me. I want to look like me. And so I'm changing all my pictures to be more real. And I will not retouch them because we're human, mm-hmm. and we have to show other people that this is what human is, as opposed to photoshopped mm-hmm. and, you know, God yeah. knows, filtered and whatever else.
Yeah, we go to one extreme or the other. This reminds me of my thesis I'm writing right now for my doctorate, and I've interviewed men on their experiences with female sex workers, and just to hear men speak so openly about who they are sexually and their desire and all of that, it's been so beautiful and enlightening, and it's so oppositional to this narrative that men are aggressive and violent and hyper erect and sex crazed and all of that. And I think that's a big part too of, you know, when I hear women's stories like Robin and Debbie, that they're scared of male sexuality. That's partly because of how male sexuality has been portrayed in the media and in studies that have, you know, these studies that have been put out to try to abolish prostitution or sex work. They say, you know, these men are so violent, but the reality is that, you know, men are vulnerable and afraid, and they lose their erections all the time, and they're insecure and they want connection, and yeah, there's also other things present. We're human and complex, but we don't need to be so afraid of male sexuality. And
I agree. I think that in the case of Robin and Debbie, they had both had terrible abuse.
Yes.
From people that I think it was their fathers or someone very mm-hmm. close to them, someone who ought to, a male who ought to have protected them, who ended up, you know, betraying them and mm-hmm. making them very afraid of mm-hmm. male power. But what I tell people is there are no men. There's just a man, right? Nobody thinks, not all women think the same, not all men think the same, and mm-hmm. we really have to see each other as just individuals. Who is this person? Rather than, oh, you're a guy, well, you want to dominate me and you want to just F me. Mm-hmm. I can probably say
I've been not using that word because I didn't know if it was,
but
okay. But yeah,
you just want to do that thing to me. Instead of the idea that guys want to connect. They're human. They want to connect. They want to be with you. They want the same things we want.
They want to please women. Men really want to know that women have pleasure when they're with them, and yeah, and they want women to dominate them as well. You know, they like, so for so many men, that's their fantasy. And yeah, I think that when you were talking about that, it made me think about how when our parents, our family members do not support us in a great way with eating, with sexuality, with safety, that, you know, how we go out as adults and we can find people to re-parent us. You know, you're in a way like a mother who's sitting here, you know, giving people the message that a healthy mother would have given them about food and their bodies and sexuality. And I know I do that with my clients. And I have fathers and mothers out there that aren't my biological parents that have given me, have taught me how to eat, have taught me how to love myself, have taught me better life habits, and including with sexuality.
Yeah, I believe you use the term psychological parents. I think so. I think you use that in the book.
It was a good one.
It was a good one. It stuck out at me because it's you're absolutely right. I mean, I think that what we do is we often treat ourselves the way we were treated, mm-hmm. and we treat other people the way we would have wanted to be treated. So how do you stop treating yourself the way you were treated if you were neglected or abused? You know, you have to recognize that there's a part of you that's identified with that abuser, mm-hmm. and gradually relinquish it, mm-hmm. and take in and identify with a new voice, a new way of seeing yourself, and a new way of being treated. That's therapy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's therapy, absolutely. And even just starting to reclaim your sexuality through self-pleasuring on your own terms. And you know, women are often surprised at how much they are likely to cry after an orgasm when you've had a lot of, you know, pent-up emotion. And it just goes to show you how healing orgasmic energy is in reconnecting with your body. And in the traditions of the East, they say that orgasmic energy comes up the spine and literally breaks up the blockages. It heals the body. It fills up the brain. So yeah, I always say we have some therapy right at home just by, you know, curling up with ourselves and starting to show ourselves love and pleasure, and listening to ourselves is also very healing.
And to do that, you have to find yourself to be worthy of pleasure, worthy of feeling better, and challenge the ideas that you're not. So many people I talk to feel as if there's something wrong with them. Mm-hmm. And often people think there's something wrong with them because they were treated badly and in some way.
Yeah.
And people who are kids who are treated badly think they're bad. Because it's a lot easier to think, okay, something's wrong with me, and that's why this is happening or this is not happening. It must be me. And it gives the illusion of hope. Oh, I can figure out what it is, and I'll change me, mm-hmm. and then I'll get everything I need.
Mm-hmm.
So it's this strategy to survive bad experiences that ends up being a conviction that there's something wrong with you. And recognizing that and challenging that so that you can be in a place of interest with yourself, so you can be naked with yourself, mm-hmm. be naked, and sort of be in a position of supporting and being interested, mm-hmm. rather than critical and judgmental.
Yeah, this reminds me so much of a client you're talking about right now who never got the message she was okay from her parents, and as a child very quickly figured out what to do to get love. And, you know, 50 years later, it's still not working, you know? And it's like, when are you going to let go of this idea that you have to be something different to get love and start to figure out who you are and just be that? And so these patterns are so powerful, but they can at any point, you know? You're never too old to do this work. And I have clients, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s. You hear about people in their 80s and 90s having breakthroughs with sexuality and relationships. And so it's a beautiful thing about this human journey, that at any point we can break out of this pattern, even if it's been with us for decades, you know, linking back to abuse or our own parenting.
Exactly. You use the term brain plasticity, which is a fancy word for, hey, we can change. We can learn something new. We learned how to relate to ourselves, and we can unlearn that and learn something new, whether it's in the area of relating to ourselves with food. And really, it's not even about food. It's about being supportive and kind to yourself, turning your inner critic into a friend, mm-hmm. so you don't need food or whatever else to distract yourself from the bad feeling, mm-hmm. or anything. So it's really about changing the way that we relate to ourselves. When that happens, so much changes.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm going to give you guys one last chance. We only have a couple minutes, but if anyone would like to just say something quickly to Lauren and me, we'd love to hear from you. 818-602-4929. What was the most surprising thing for you about writing the book?
Oh, gosh. The most surprising thing, I think for me, you know, I was writing The New Rules of Sex, I was trying to figure out what was true, because there were so many voices out there telling me, you know, that I had essentially messed up my relationships because I wasn't using my sexuality in a way I was supposed to, you know, which the story in our culture is still sort of wait for marriage, have one partner, you know, this story. To go through,
only if you're a woman, because if you're a guy,
right.
you shouldn't wait for marriage. You should go out and sow your wild oats, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So I think, just learning where that story came from, how untrue it was, you know, because I still had some conflict. There was the part of me that went, that's ridiculous. And then there was the other, the part of me that went, oh, but what if it is true, you know? And what if there is something really, really bad about me, or I've ruined it because I, you know, I thought that man loved me and I was going to be with him forever and I had sex with him, and now, you know, like, just all of these stories that were causing me pain, I was able to find my way out of them through the research and the truth, and to find out just how incredibly sexual women are. I think that was so surprising to me too. And I actually am doing an edit on The New Rules of Sex now for a second edition, and I've added in a whole section kind of expanding on our sexual history, And all throughout the Middle Ages, and for just thousands of years, they were, all of the sermons were basically saying, like, women are so sexual, like, and so lustful, like, we need to control them. And so this whole, the whole story was women are the more sexual ones, and then all of a sudden it switches at one point in, like, the 1800s, I think, 1800s, and they suddenly go, oh, men are the more sexual ones, and they're the predators, and women became these very, like, chaste, and then by the height of the Victorian era, the medical textbooks said a healthy woman has no sexual desire. Wow. You know, and so literally we're, I tell people, we are coming out of, in just the last couple hundred years, medicine, and everybody believed that a healthy woman had no sexual desire, and so we're just at the beginning of sort of reclaiming that. So just how fresh that is, how fresh circumcision is. I mean, we still circumcise boys, and that comes out of the anti-masturbation movement of the Victorian era, and we were also circumcising or performing clitorectomies on young girls up until the, like, 1930s for masturbating. We look at other cultures and say, oh, you're performing female genital mutilation, but we were doing it and are still doing it right here and circumcising boys. And again, it's all about this sex fear and this anti-masturbation movement. So those are some of the surprising things. And there's much more. You got to buy the book.
There is much more. I really recommend you guys go out and buy this book. It is so chock full of history and breaking myths and interesting stories about carrots and female ejaculation and more.
And love.
So,
yeah.
Lauren, where can they find more about you and where can they get the book?
At laurenbrehm.com, and you can get The New Rules of Sex or The New American Family on Amazon, Audible, and Kindle.
I highly recommend it. And that is our show for today. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Pacific here on LA Talk Radio to give you the skinny on weight loss without dieting and everything pertaining to health and wellness. You can find me at winthedietwar.com, and I'll see you next week. Bye.
You're listening to The Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle-Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.